Good morning, all. I'm excited to be back and teach today. I'm talking from a couple of different sources, but one of the main sources, I want you to turn in your Bible to Romans chapter 12, and it talks about how do we live as Christ. And so most of what I'm speaking about today comes from that chapter in the Bible. And so as I'm referring to it, you can look down and double check what I'm saying. I've also done some research on the Gottman Institute about relationships. So if this is something that super interests you, you can go look at that. And then also this book called The Bait of Satan by John Bevere, Living Free from the Deadly Trap of Offense. Only read if you're ready to be super convicted. Okay, so not my words, a rephrasing of those three things. So today, we're talking about conflict. Yeah, super exciting. Good topic. All right. We have been talking about how we are made for community. Pastor Eric has been talking about that and talking about a lot of different relationships. And I just wanted to start by reiterating that we are made for community, made to belong, to be known, to be loved. And you didn't know it today, but you're getting a science lesson. So, hear this. Every positive face-to-face interaction that you have within your community, especially with people that you trust, releases four happy brain chemicals in your brain. Dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins. What do those do? Well, they give you feelings of joy, connection, the motivation to complete tasks, the drive to want to set a goal and achieve it. They help you sleep better. They help you eat. They help you feel happy. They're natural pain killers just from talking to one another. So you didn't even know that our community time out there was totally life-giving. You're not just getting good food. You're getting a dose of amazing chemicals as well. They have done studies where they have seen participants who have a friend by their side while completing a tough task actually have a lower heart rate than those who are working alone. In one study, people even judged a hill to be less steep when they were walking with a friend. Okay, having friendship, community, true community, lowers your risk of stroke, heart attack, diabetes, depression, anxiety, dementia, Alzheimer's, and obesity. Your life expectancy rises. You are less susceptible to any kind of thing that's attacking your immune system just by living in community. Your babies, who are actually deprived of a connection of community when they are first born, can develop physical ailments, or they might even die without having that connection in their lives. You are two times more likely to die if you are not living in community, a risk factor that is the same as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So being in community is super healthy. Why is it healthy? Well, because God designed our bodies to want to be in community. And so when we're doing what he wants, there's going to be all of these benefits. And it starts with our God, who is the Trinity. Our eternal, amazing God literally has been in relationship for all of time before and will be in relationship for all of time. So if we are made in his image, a God who is literally love, because you can't have love if you're living in relationship. I don't know about you, right? You can't live with someone for all of eternity and not love them. And we are made in his image, of course. Of course, we are made to be in relationship. He says it's not good for man to be alone. And then in the New Testament talks about how we as the body of Christ are called to live as one, to connect. Whether you are a Christian or not, community has its benefits. But here's the reality. In 2023, the U.S. General declared an epidemic of loneliness and isolation in the United States. 50% of adults regularly feel alone and like they don't have community. 1 in 4 Americans are estranged from a family member. 45% of first marriages end in divorce. 65% of second marriages end in divorce. On average, 2.8 hours a week are spent managing conflict at work. 42% of people have had disputes with neighbors, and 75% report not liking one of their neighbors. And 1 in 5 people have had an argument online. We're made for community and made to live together, but that is the reality of our society. We live in a culture that makes it so easy to disconnect. Sometimes it's a slow drift, life stages, someone moves away, we get a little busy. Other times, though, it's a conflict, a disappointment, a betrayal. We have different values. A series of small events causes us to lose trust. And instead of leaning in to that uncomfortable moment, we can just block a person online. We can cancel them. We can shop at a different grocery store. We can ignore their calls. We don't even have to have a goodbye conversation. We can just ghost them. That's where you just like pitter-patter off and stop talking, and eventually you realize it's been 10 years since you've talked. And then we hold grudges, even after we've cut off contact. This disconnection, unfortunately, is not new. It's not just for our society. At the beginning of time, when our God of relationship created us, he made Adam and Eve to be in relationship with him and with each other. And the very first casualty of sin was relationship. The relationship with God was broken. Adam and Eve had a perfect life, able to walk with God. We see in Genesis that he was coming into the garden. They knew he was coming. That meant it was a regular thing that they sat and watched these sunsets together without shame, without guilt, being vulnerable and completely themselves. And sin destroys that relationship. And Adam, rather than walking with God, says, "You could have done better with the wife that you gave me." And Eve says, "It's not my fault. You made me this way. You made that that way. It's not me." And the relationship between God and man was broken. And the relationship of marriage was broken in that moment. If you are going to enter into relationship, you are also going to enter into conflict. Take this stat, for example, from the Pew Research. 100% of all marriages face conflict. Yes, they researched that. Okay. Sometimes when it happens as a Christian, we feel even worse because we go, well, I'm meant to live with people. I'm meant to be able to show love. And on top of the feelings of a loss of relationship, we also have shame and guilt and fear. So what happens when we disconnect? How do we reconcile? Back to the science. Okay. So there's this word that I love. It's one of my favorite words. It's called metacognition. Okay. And metacognition means thinking about thinking. And the more you think about the way that you think, the more you are able to change the way that you think, which is actually a biblical thing. We are called to renew our minds. Okay. And our brain is amazing and fascinating, and we're still learning new things every day. Like, we have just scratched the surface on what we understand about brains. But if you start to think about how you think, you can change it. And that also means if we think about how our brain processes conflict, we can change the way that our brain processes conflict. So today you're going to learn, what does your brain do? Okay. I want you to hold your hand up like this. Okay. All right. So our brain looks something like this. Here's our spinal cord coming down back of your neck. Okay. And at the front of your brain, right up here, this is called the prefrontal cortex. That's where you do all of your thinking and decision-making. And when you have hormones, that part doesn't work. Okay? And underneath the prefrontal cortex, your thumb, is the amygdala. Okay? And the amygdala is the thing that causes you to do fight or flight. Okay? So here's the thing, though. If you are in fight or flight and your amygdala is controlling your brain, your thinking cortex shuts off. it stops working. If your thinking cortex is in place and you're using it, then your amygdala doesn't take control. So what happens when you get in a conflict, we are made to avoid conflict. It's a survival technique. We don't want to do it. It's uncomfortable. It doesn't feel good. I don't want to do it. Okay. So your brain is like, we're going to do anything we can to get out of this. And it will either do, we're going to run, or I'm going to stand, fight, win. That is the only thing that I see. Okay. And your brain sends out this chemical called cortisol, which is like sugar to the brain. So like the other happy chemicals, that's like the ones that keep you happy for a long time. Cortisol is like a shot of adrenaline. It sends sugar. It feels good in the moment, but it just wrecks the brain. It shuts off everything. And your amygdala is also right next to where you make memories. And so in the moment of conflict, if your amygdala is firing off and your thinking cortex is off, it's also shaping your memory of that moment, which means when you look back on it later, it's colored by the emotion of fight or flight that you were feeling. So even if you're like trying to think through a conflict, you're not going to remember it correctly because your brain was already like, nah, I was feeling that. So that's what the truth is in that moment. Yeah. Okay. What else does our brain do to us? Well, our brain always wants to make us the hero of the story. Your frame of reference is through your own eyes. No one else, you're not the side person in someone else's story. You're not a secondary, right? The world is about you and everyone else, right, is a player in your life, which means that if I get into an argument with my husband, Mitch, my brain is immediately going to go rather than, huh, I wonder what's going on, what I might have done. Oh, he must be, and that's why he's treating me that way. Okay. Our brain automatically attributes something in that, okay, probably all you married couples, you know you're hungry. And you're like driving, you're like, what do you want to eat? What do you want to eat? And that's like always where you get into a fight. At least we do. Yeah. Okay. And my mind in those moments always goes, oh, he's not deciding because he's lazy, because he doesn't care, okay? But if I put myself in that situation, I'd be like, of course I'm acting that way because I'm hungry. Like, I'm not that person. And instead, we attribute those things. So when we come to conflict, first off, our amygdala takes over. Okay. It goes, oh, fight or flight. We have to decide what to do. Let's pick one of them. And also, let's color this thing. And also, you're the hero of your story. You have done nothing wrong. You just keep remembering that. Okay. Then, after it's done, your brain was like, oh, wow, we really avoided that conflict. That felt great. Let's make sure we always keep on doing that. And once you form a pattern in your brain, like you literally form a rut in your brain, like you can see it on scans, that is the path your brain wants to follow because you made it easy for your brain. It was happy. It got you out of the difficult situation, and so it said, well, let's do that. And now next time I see that person, maybe I'm not as open with them. Maybe I start to see the things that they do as like, oh, they're laughing over there. They must be laughing at me. And in my mind, that justifies me staying farther away from them and not having anything to do with them. And our mind begins to justify. And every time that it does, and it keeps putting the person as the enemy and you as the hero of your story, it makes that groove deeper. And the more you avoid or the more you go in conflict, the more you let your amygdala take over and remove the prefrontal cortex from doing the work that it needs to do. Most relationships break down because of trust. And it's not usually just one moment. It's usually a series of tiny little moments of trust breaking down, and then our brain fills in the holes, and we assume that that is truth. And rather than looking at the truth that is true, the truth that my husband is not a selfish man, the truth that he is made in the image of God, I frame it as what makes me feel comfortable. Conflict isn't our enemy. The fear of conflict is our enemy. The goal should not be to win or avoid conflict, but to engage in it. Because here's the other thing. Your brain becomes stagnant without conflict. You've seen that, right? Like a toddler, they want to try everything in the world, and they are diametrically opposed to their parent who's trying to keep them safe, and they just want to explore. But they see that parents who don't let their kids explore, who don't let their kids actually fight for different things, have fewer brain connections than those that let them actually try hard things and grow in grit. And it's the same with our relationships. They can be okay, but conflict and overcoming conflict causes relationships to grow exponentially. So how do we get in the way of our amygdala? If we are created to go fight or flight, how do we get that prefrontal cortex back down to say, stop, I need to think, what are we meant to do? I want to go to scripture. Romans chapter 12. This passage was written to the people in Romans. Interestingly, it doesn't say the Roman church. It just says the people who believe in God in Rome. So he wasn't even like talking to a specific, he was just saying like anyone who's going to be a part of this movement, you need to hear this. And we had a clash between the Gentiles and the Jews who were fundamentally opposed on several different things. And so Paul is talking to them about, this is the gospel. Here is what Jesus came and did for us. Here is who he is. Here is the truth. Okay? What can we do to put aside these differences? And now, how do you live as a Christian? Okay, I'm going to start in verse 9 and read to 18. Because I love. All right. Romans chapter 12. Number 1, he tells us who you need to be. 1. Love must be sincere. You need to hate what is evil and cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Honor others above yourselves. Do not be lacking in zeal. Keep your spiritual fervor. Keep serving the Lord and one another. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Then verse 14 says, well, what do you do, though, if people don't treat you well? Because here's the thing. Nero had just come into power as well when he wrote this. And so that meant the persecution of the Christians was starting 10 years after this is written. Nero burns the cities to the ground, right? So we have persecution already beginning. So they're like, okay, yeah, I know we're meant to do that, but what about? Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. It's a limit and a call to action. You are not responsible for someone else's response. That is the job of the Holy Spirit. That's their relationship with Christ that they need to work on. But you are responsible for your heart in the matter. Number one, if you're going forward to repair a thing, right? We've all heard about the Matthew principle, like go and talk to the brother. But before you do that, wait, hold on, because your cortisol might still be pumping through your body. Be wise in the kind of relationship you're trying to repair. Living at peace may look different to each situation. Reconciliation is not safe for everyone, so I'm not talking about those relationships. I'm talking about the day-to-day conflict. We are called to be peacemakers, not peacekeepers. We're not just going to keep the peace, right? That might involve having a tough conversation then. That might involve looking at yourself and searching with humility. It might require uncomfortability. forgiveness might be the first step. And forgiveness only requires one person. Someone doesn't have to say sorry to you for you to forgive them. It only requires your heart. That's it. No one else needs to be involved. They can be, but that's the first step in reconciliation. It's a heart posture. Reconciliation requires two people that are actually willing to reconcile. You cannot reconcile with someone that does not want to reconcile. You just can't. That's not what reconciliation is. It requires both. And then there's restoration, because when we have conflict with someone, usually our conflict spills out into our community. And so together, you might need to make repairs to the rest of your community that broke bridges in your conflict with each other. Before you go and talk, you need to prepare your heart. Before you storm off in righteous anger, wait and take a breath. How do you get your amygdala back under control? You breathe. That's it. Four deep breaths, breathing for 2 minutes, that causes the cortisol to lower down and puts your brain back in order. It's okay to say in the middle of conflict and like talking with people, I just need a second, because you might do more damage if you continue to stay there than if you go back and you say, what is the truth about this person? What is the truth about this situation? And let it go down. It takes 2 to 3 hours for the cortisol in your body to return to a normal level. So maybe you need 2 to 3 hours too. Okay? Pray. Don't gossip. In your anger, do not sin and cause more brokenness. Because whatever perception you put on the situation, you can cause others to put that same perception onto it. You don't always know what truth is. If you're angry, go to God. Whine to him about it. Because he loves you. He loves that person too. He's the best one to talk to. Ask yourself, why should I go to this person? Am I doing this for God's glory? Will this build the kingdom? Am I doing this because I love them and I want to fix them, or because I want to be right? Do it for love, because he first loved us. And if you do it in love, you're doing it in the right thing. And that can help on both fronts, either taking a step back if you don't need to confront it, or knowing, no, I actually have to, because it's the more loving thing. That's what God did for us, right? He showed us our sin. He had to confront us in order for reconciliation to happen. If he hadn't done that, if he hadn't shown us our sin, there wouldn't have been reconciliation. So sometimes that is the path that needs to happen. Finally, you can't go with the agenda of reconciliation. If you go in with the agenda to change someone, you don't really love them where they are at. So you need to think through, am I actually doing this in love? Can I love this person where they're at? And this is the hardest one. Before you go, you need to be ready to forgive. Because no matter what that person does, no matter what their response is to you, your responsibility to forgive them is still the same. And so if you can't go ready to forgive, then you shouldn't be going and talking to them. Your heart needs to be right. And it might just be a, God, I don't love them. Can you help me to love them? I'm not ready to forgive, but I have the willingness to forgive. And that is the start, where it can start in the head, renewing your mind, changing it, telling yourself what truth is, will eventually take over the emotions as well. Unforgiveness leads to bitterness and loneliness. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He had forgiveness for us. While we stood there shaking our hands at him, still hurting him, he continued on with his ministry of reconciliation. He didn't just forgive us, right? He reconciled with us. If it does require a conversation, choose a good time and a good place. Listen actively. You should be quick to listen and slow to speak. One of my teacher friends always says to her students, God gave you 2 ears that are always working and 1 mouth that can close. Wise. Okay? take their perspective. We are meant to mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with those who rejoice. Remember that they are made in God's image, and so any thought that you have about them is about God. Go back to truth. Be sincere and vulnerable. Don't say, I'm sorry if you felt hurt. I'm sorry I hurt you. Share responsibility. Commit to growth. And if it doesn't go well, that's okay. It might be another conversation later on. It doesn't have to be today. My sister and I were estranged for years and years. It took us 10 years to get to the place where we were okay again. Ask yourself, did I do everything I could to live at peace without compromising the peace in my relationship with Christ? Where do you start? Practice with God. You already have a party that's ready to reconcile with you. He wants relationship. He wants growth. He has proven to be trustworthy and of love. He is the Father, the friend, and the God waiting with open arms. He who made us could have avoided us. He could have fought us. He could have ghosted us. He could have just walked away. But instead, he looked at us while we were still sinners and continued in a plan for empathy. He literally stepped into our shoes and experienced the worst of us. And in that act, he made it possible for us to do the same. And we are called to live like him. Have you given a piece of your heart to resentment, bitterness, or offense that should be filled with the love of Christ? Is God calling you today out of a rut of conflict or avoidance and into a place of peace? God, thank you for your deep, deep love for us. You loved us while we still hurt you. You pursued us. You allowed us to have relationship with you. And even as we continue to hurt you, you continue to pursue us. We thank you for that. Lord, I pray that we would be peacemakers, that you would give us the wisdom to know when to dig in and do the uncomfortable thing, and when to learn to let go and just forgive. I pray that we would be a community of peace, God, that you would bring to mind truth about others in this room, in our community, in our world, that we would see others through your eyes, Lord. And that we would have the courage to live in peace.